Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha. Ho'o kolo kolo ki eke hanohano o ka maku aina o Hawaii. E nao mai, e malio mai, ilohe ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. Inoho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-20-650, State of Hawaii versus Stanley Canosa. Arguing for the petitioner, Stanley Canosa, Sean A. Louise. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Stephen K. Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning. Aloha. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. Counselor, are you ready to proceed? All right. So, Mr. Louise, both sides have 30 minutes. You've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning light 20 minutes in, and then again at the end of the 30, Mr. Tsushima, we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go, and then again at the end of your argument. And both of our counsel, when you approach the podium, if you'd like to remove your mask while you're speaking, you may do so. Thank you very much. Please proceed, Mr. Louise.
Good morning and aloha to Chief Justice and Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. Shawnee Louise appearing on behalf of petitioner, appellant, defendant, Stanley Canosa. And this is an interesting case because I believe this is a case of first impression before this court. I researched thoroughly on Westlaw when I started to do the lower court proceedings.
Could you put the mic just up a little bit closer?
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Is that better, Your Honor? Thank you. I started to research on the Westlaw looking into this matter for Mr. Canosa that we were discussing about whether or not the state can actually resentence someone to an extended or an additional punishment once the underlying maximum sentence has been fulfilled. And what the argument is that I'm making on behalf of petitioner is that in September of 2009, Mr. Canosa was taken into custody by the state, and he remained in custody from that time forward. He was never released on bail or supervised release at any time. And then subsequently, on September 29th, 2019, he actually fulfilled the requirement of making 10 years on the underlying charges that he was convicted of. And he was convicted, now he was charged with a sex assault charge, a burglary charge, and an unlawful entry. However, from two trials, there were two trials in this case, and during both trials, Mr. Canosa was acquitted of the sex assault charge. And later during my argument, I believe that's of significance, and I will point out as I argue why I believe that is of significance in this case.
Acquitted, or was there a mistrial, counsel?
Both times the jury could not make a finding of that charge. So on the second time, it was dismissed without prejudice, and the state never refiled the charge at any time.
Thank you,
Your Honor. So what happened then is in November of 2018, Mr. Canosa brought his appeal from third trial because there was a first trial and that went to verdict. And then there was another trial, and there was a mistrial during the second trial because he was upset with his counsel. He asked the counsel to withdraw. The court allowed the counsel to withdraw. And then there was a mistrial, and then they had to do a second trial. So there was two full trials and one partial trial. And this is the third appeal. There was a first, second, and now we're here for this third appeal. And in November of 2018, on his third appeal, the ICA issued an order. It affirmed the judgments of convictions on the two counts he was convicted of, the burglary and the underlying unlawful entry into premises. However, again, he was not convicted on the sex assault. So he appealed that to the ICA in November of 2018. The ICA ordered a resentencing, and they asked for a resentencing of the case. And then in January of 2019, I had filed a writ of certiorari to review, and that was actually denied. And then the state did not move for resentencing of Mr. Canosa until June of 2020. And he was ultimately sentenced on June 4th, 2020. And basically, Mr. Canosa, I will argue, has no obligation to ask for himself to be sentenced. That is the state's burden to bring Mr. Canosa forward for sentencing, because the state is the plaintiff in the case and the defendant is the defendant, and the state failed to prosecute for 10 months. It had 10 months to resentence Mr. Canosa, and it chose to basically sit on its hands and not resentence Mr. Canosa until his underlying maximum penalty for the charge in September 29th of 2019, he fulfilled the underlying maximum for the most severe punishment he faced, which was the burglary.
Mr. Luis, may I ask you a question about the underlying case? You said that the state, I thought he was resentenced on June 4th, 2020, but you said the state moved to have him resentenced in June of 2020.
Well, ultimately, yes, Your Honor.
So
ultimately,
how was the matter put on the calendar? Through a motion by the state?
The state asked for a status conference at some point, and then somehow it ended up on the calendar.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Is it your position, counsel, that it's only the state's obligation to comply with a remand order? Does the court not have some obligation?
The court also hasn't. I would believe and argue that the court would also have a obligation as well. Also because it received the remand order and it was ordered to resentence Mr. Canosa. So that would be an additional argument that I would set forth, that the court also did not bring Mr. Canosa in for resentencing timely before his underlying maximum on the burglary of 10 years expired. So when he was resentenced on June 4th, of 2020, his underlying maximum for the burglary already had expired on September 29th, 2019.
Mr. Luis, let's say a person is convicted of five unauthorized entry into dwelling cases. You know, he or she went on a rampage in a neighborhood, and the jury makes the requisite extended findings. This is a persistent offender. We need to extend him 10 years to protect the public. The individual appeals that case. The appellate courts say, you know, the sentencing was unlawful. Maybe there wasn't a right to allocution, whatever it is. It gets remanded back down there. And due to delays, maybe pretrial delays or the appellate process, when it gets remanded down there, he's racked up or she's racked up 6 years. Is it your position that the court at resentencing cannot impose the extended term sentencing because the ordinary term of imprisonment has run?
Yes, Your Honor. And a second argument would be, additionally, the information that the court used to resentence Mr. Canosa was stale. It had a jury finding from 2016 And it's hard to really say that that evidence could be used against Mr. Canosa in 2020 when he was resented.
Let me ask another situation. Let's say there was an appeal. The person goes down on the five UEDs, but due to maybe an interlock that happened earlier, or the guy went through five attorneys, when he comes up for sentencing, he's racked up 6 years. Is it your position the court could not do a consecutive sentencing on those five C felonies?
Is the question posed that he would have reached the maximum?
He'd racked up 6 years of pre-sentence detention credit. He's getting sentenced on five UEDs. Is it your position that because he's exceeded the ordinary max that he could not receive a consecutive term sentence?
Yes, because he's already fulfilled his underlying ordinary max. So how can the court extend a sentence that has already been fulfilled?
Does this incentivize a defendant to delaying a case beyond the ordinary statutory max to avoid a consecutive sentence?
No, because the burden is on the state and the court to resentence.
What if an individual has 10 misdemeanor offenses, has racked up a year and a half jail by the time she gets sentenced? Is the court foreclosed from consecutive sentencing?
I think it needs to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis. And I think the individual facts of each case have to be analyzed separately.
Well, you would agree in that scenario that I just posed, that ordinary max, he had 18 months in, that would have exceeded the ordinary max. Under your logic, the defendant would only be able to be sentenced to 1 year, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be the case?
I'd have to know more about, but that should be the correct answer. But I guess the question is what came first? Did he already exceed the ordinary term? And then did he object timely when he was being resentenced? Mr. Cano?
It's not a resentence. I think if I understand Justice Edden's question, the case doesn't get to trial. He fires his lawyer multiple times. So it's not. Once he's now convicted of, I guess, 10 misdemeanors, it's been more than a year before he comes up for sentencing. Under your view, would you say at that point he's not eligible for extended term sentencing under the logic that you're advancing here today?
I don't think so, because it wasn't from an order where he was resentenced, like subject to resentencing.
I don't understand the principle you're advocating for. Are you saying that it's an absolute rule that once the underlying term of one has passed, if the person hasn't been sentenced, they can't be sentenced to extended term sentencing?
No. If there's alternative punishments under which a defendant can be sentenced or resentenced, and he's already fulfilled his underlying maximum punishment, then what authority would the court have at that point?
The question Justice Edens asked was related to consecutive sentencing on a misdemeanor. And, you know, it's like he's not sentenced for a year and a half. Are you asking for a blanket rule, or are you asking us to look at the circumstances of your client's case?
I'm asking to look at the circumstances for my client's case.
Can I ask some clarification on that? It was my understanding that you were taking the position that once the ordinary maximum has been served, if there hasn't been an extended sentence, at that point, the court doesn't have jurisdiction. And at that point, the defendant has to be released because there hasn't been a determination that he qualifies for an extended sentence. And it's my understanding that your position is that there is a constitutional deprivation of liberty where the court loses jurisdiction and where the defendant has not been at least given the opportunity to make a decision as to whether extended sentencing should take place. So when you say you should look at the facts of the case. I'd be interested in clarification on that. Aren't you saying that once the maximum term is served, the court can't use as an excuse for further delay the fact that an enhanced sentence could take place? Because if I understand the analysis correctly of the state, there's a maximum, for example, in this case, there's a maximum sentence that was imposed of 20 years eventually, right? An enhanced sentence of 20 years. So from the state's point of view, the court could have waited 20 years. You could, because there was no, from the point of view of the state, there was no reason for the court to have to sentence the defendant within the ordinary maximum term as long as there was a potential enhanced sentence of 20 years.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And it could incentivize the court to wait as well. What if the court waited until Mr. Canosa had served already 19 years and 11 months?
Why would the court do that, though? What do you mean incentivize the court? What does the court get out of waiting? I'm sorry, Justice Wilson.
You can go ahead and answer the question.
Yeah, because the prosecution, of course, would bring the sentencing forward, but then the court, if the prosecution's asking for a certain punishment on 19 years, 11 months, the prosecution could move forward and ask that the defendant should be resentenced to a consecutive or some additional punishment in addition to what he's already received after he's already fulfilled one of alternative punishments.
And isn't there a due process interest that the defendant has after the maximum ordinary term has been served? And in terms of the federal court in the Betterman case, where Justice Sotomayor said that there actually is a liberty interest that applies at the time of sentencing, correct? And if there is a liberty interest and the defendant doesn't get an opportunity to address whether there should be an enhanced sentence for a period of time after the maximum ordinary has been served, isn't there an argument that the defendant is deprived of the opportunity to start rehabilitation, deprived of the opportunity to have a sentence that would allow him to move forward with or her move forward with rehabilitation? The delay, in other words, forecloses that opportunity. So I'm interested in your position as to the federal constitutional due process right under Betterman.
That's one of the things that we argued before the ICA is the unlawful restraint of liberty, because in Mr. Canosa's specific facts, because he served already the ordinary term, if he was sentenced and he fulfilled going up to his 10 years, he would have been eligible for certain parole hearings at a certain point. But because of the delay, and now he's been extended to the 20 years, he has to wait his turn to get through his courses. And the state is actually ordering him to take sex offender treatment, even though he's never been convicted of a recent sex assault case in this case. And the parole board is actually ordering him to take sex offender treatment. And because he's been given a 20-year term, the normal thing is that the defendants wait until very close to the end of their 20-year term before they get to be able to take the classes and graduate with the,
But that's not an issue before this court at this time. However, in your certiorari application, you did assert a 14th Amendment liberty, due process liberty violation. My question is, are you not asserting rights under the state constitution also?
Yeah, there's also the same applicable right under the state constitution.
We have recognized a due process interest in sentencing also, I know.
Yes.
If that's the case, Mr. Luiz, that there is a constitutional right under our Hawaii state constitution as well, liberty interest in this period when the defendant's awaiting sentencing, are you intending to bring a motion before this court for immediate release pending the decision of our court? In other words, a motion based on the proposition that the defendant has now been held over 3 years illegally and at least pending our decision that he should be released. Is that your intent?
Yes, that would be my intent as well now, moving forward, that we've made it to oral argument and based on addressing some of the points of the court, I would like the opportunity to be able to present that motion.
Mr. Luis, if I could, I want to go back to 2018. When the ICA issued its judgment on appeal back in November of 18, did it vacate the 20-year term or did it leave the 20-year term and the 10-year term intact and simply vacate the consecutive nature of the sentencing? Because your argument seems to be premised on the notion that there was no sentence and therefore it defaulted back to the 10 years. But when I look at the judgment on appeal, the ICA talks about the judgment of conviction and sentence and says it is vacated to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences in violation of HRS 706-609 and is remanded for resentencing consistent with the summary disposition order. So what the judgment says, it's vacated to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences. So under that language, wasn't there an operative 20-year sentence for the burglary count that remained intact after the ICA's judgment?
See, when you look at the judgment, though, it's a judgment of conviction and sentence. So the court, when the ICA vacated the judgment, it vacated the judgment to the extent, but there was actually a new judgment of conviction and sentence, notice of entry issued on June 4th, and also...
Well, that's the June. We're talking now in 2018. So the remand, in other words, there's a retrial, I guess, too, in 2016. Case comes up on appeal. There's a 20-year sentence, a 10-year sentence. They were consecutive. He challenged that. The ICA, in its judgment on appeal, says the judgment of conviction and sentence is vacated to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences in violation of HRS. So does that not imply that the 20-year sentence remained intact? It's simply the consecutive nature of that sentence and the 10-year sentence that was vacated. That's the state's argument. The state makes that argument. What's your response to it?
The response is that the court still addressed it like it was a new issue to address and addressed it.
And if that is the state's argument, would that even be proper under Rule 35B, which is very clear that the court may reduce a sentence within 90 days of a remand. So Rule 35B of the Rules of Penal Procedure is clear that the court retained would have had the authority to not do an extended if they had done it within the 90 days of the remand. Doesn't that remove the court's discretion to consider sentencing? And we also have a recent case saying that upon resentencing, the court can consider the circumstances of the defendant at the time.
And that's one of the things I argued before the ICA is that the lower court first was that the lower court was not considering the passage of time from 2016 to 2020 when he was resentenced on June 4th, changed circumstances, no problems in the facility, no new evidence, no additional threats, no new charges, because inmates, frankly, even pick up charges in prison. There was nothing in the record. The record was silent on any justification to do that. And we asked for reconsideration on June 4th, 2020, to revisit that issue because...
The court did not convene a new jury to consider the criteria for extended term, and there was no objection from the defense.
Well, we were
asking. If it were a brand new sentencing procedure, wouldn't the court have been obligated to assemble a jury to consider the criteria for the extended term, but there wasn't. The court accepted the jury's previous determination. So, and there was no objection. But so isn't that, aren't you accepting that the, because you didn't object to the court using the previous extended term determination by a jury, isn't that argument waived?
I don't believe so, because we objected to using the extended sentence, and the court under the Booker case with the U.S. Supreme Court, it's clear that other than a prior sentence, you cannot resentence someone to an extended term without a jury. So there was no.
Let me ask for clarification on that with respect to the way the sentencing court would consider the effect of the jury's determination of eligibility. On remand, the court says that the court interprets the remand as having vacated the prior sentences, plural, not just the consecutive or the sentences that are extended. It's appears to cover all the sentences, prior sentences. And then when the resentencing takes place, the court has to consider, as Justice McKenna was alluding to, has to consider the factors in 706, 606 in determining what the appropriate sentence is, because there is a due process right. I think this is covered by Justice Sotomayor as well and Betterman, that there's a due process right to make sure that the sentencing reflects individual considerations of the individual. So wouldn't this determination of eligibility be just one of the factors that the sentencing court would consider on remand? Just it would be something that would be considered, but it's not dispositive from the point of view of requiring that there be an extended sentence imposed. Is that correct?
No, the court had discretion not to enter an extended sentence because we were still raising, we were still entitled under 35B for that request to have that sentence revisited. And the additional due process violation is that the state waited so long to bring the case forward, and the court was not considering the changed circumstances in his case. And that was argued, and I think by implication, if I'm arguing that you can't use an extended sentence in the sentencing that's already stale and no longer accurate, that you can't resentence the defendant to that, because that's just a due process violation. To resentence someone on information that is no longer accurate, because the court has to still use accurate information in reaching its sentence. And that was never addressed before the ICA was the appropriateness of whether there was changed circumstances. I mean, when the case was remanded for resentencing, the ICA never even had that issue before it, whether or not Mr. Canosa had changed circumstances, because he was doing both the direct appeal and an appeal of direct appeal of the conviction and appeal of the sentence that was imposed as well. But there were changed circumstances, and the changed circumstances didn't become even fully ripe to even argue until the passage of time on June 4th, 2020. And that's really when it was ripe to argue that issue. And that's why I raised that. And by implication, if I'm raising that you cannot resentence them because that information's expired, I mean, the court would still, if I'm making an objection that the information's expired, the necessary implication of that is the court would have to convene a jury. Because if I'm saying that the information is stale, then the court should have ordered a resentencing investigation with a jury to look at the information that would be submitted before it of whether or not Mr.
Canosa. Would that be especially true if the state exercised its discretion or the court exercised its discretion to continue the sentencing for another 9 years with the understanding that the sentencing could take place 20 years after the defendant was incarcerated? right? I mean, it seems to me that's the argument of the state, that it, because there was an enhanced sentence available of 20 years, the court could have waited up to 20 years in order to do the sentencing.
But that would be a severe due process violation, restraint of liberty, because it's affecting the person's right to be eligible for parole and all kinds of other additional due process implications. I mean, it's really, there's a due process, severe due process violation that even the ICA recognized when it denied the appeal subject to Rule 40 proceedings. But we were asking to go beyond the Rule 40 proceedings because the maximum underlying sentence was fulfilled, and he should have been sentenced timely before that happened, so it could have been addressed at the time before the 10 years. But he had already exceeded his maximum 10 years, so that's where we're arguing that he had a due process implication, that he was deprived of not only the due process but also an unlawful restraint, and he should be released because he fulfilled the maximum underlying punishment. There were changed circumstances that made the information that the court had on June 4th, 2020, not accurate. We argue that they can't use those facts because they're already expired. So the only alternative is for a jury trial to be convened to see if the state has significant new facts to justify.
Mr. Luis, you know, there's two verdicts in this case. One is the guilty verdict in counts 1 and 3. And the second verdict, because it was a special interrogatory on a form entitled verdict, was the two affirmative answers to those questions, you know, whether he's a persistent or multiple offender and whether, you know, extended term is necessary for the protection of the public. Those are both verdicts. Are you suggesting that that verdict, and I'm talking about the extended term sentencing verdict, should somehow have been overturned? I mean, that just makes the defendant eligible under the court's discretion for an extended term sentencing. Is it your position that that jury verdict was overturned by the ICA or by other developments?
It was overturned by implication by the other developments, that the information was stale and no longer applicable to
the verdict or the imposition of the extended sentence?
The imposition of the extended term.
Because the verdict is there, and I don't understand how the verdict, whether it's the guilty verdict or let's call it the penalty stage verdict, can somehow be overturned. What I think you're arguing is that the discretion of the court was somehow hemmed.
That's exactly what I'm arguing, Your Honor, that the facts were stale, no longer applicable, and the discretion was gone for the court to resentence him to an extended sentence based on facts that were stale and outdated and no longer accurate, because under the 706...
Well, couldn't you as defense counsel have presented evidence or argument at least that indeed that extended term was not necessary for the protection of the public? I mean, isn't that what happens at sentencing hearings all the time?
I believe I did argue that in the transcript.
But the court rejected that argument, right?
Yes. And that's what I was voicing. How can you use this information? It's 4 years old and outdated.
But you could argue, you yourself could have argued recent aspects of Mr. Canosa's life that would suggest that an extended term wasn't necessary for the protection of the public.
Yes. At some point during the case, I did argue that, and I was asking
Did you request a new jury trial on the issue of whether it was necessary, an extended term was necessary for protection of the public?
I didn't ask for a new jury trial because I was objecting to using the information. So then the state would have to ask for a jury trial to analyze, because I'm objecting. No, you can't use this information. It's outdated. So,
and what is your position as to, I mean, in terms of putting aside your client's case right now, you're saying 4 years is too long for the issue of protection of the public, because the other questions are questions of fact that are pretty clear from the record, I think. But in terms of whether it's necessary to have an extended term, for protection of public, you're saying 4 years is too long if it, the resentencing is within, is 4 years later.
Especially on these facts that he actually was in custody for 4 years and didn't commit another crime while he was in the facility. And he had lots of, 4 years, that's 365 days times four. He was a model inmate. He's been a model inmate. And that's the thing, is that how can you use information saying that, because he's a different man. That's the whole point of being incarcerated, is so you can change your circumstances and become a different, you know, kind of like a new creation while you're learning how to rehabilitate, not only with the state, but my client has taken extreme measures to rehabilitate himself, to cooperate with me, to, I have my correspondence file at my office is about that thick. And he goes to the law library all the time. He studies the law. He stays out of trouble. He complies.
Justice Wilson has a question. Also, we've gone over quite a bit, so perhaps we can have Justice Wilson's question and then move on to Mr. Tsushima.
I mean, your point about the potential due process violations that arise the longer sentencing is delayed is a point that pertains to the sense of the determination that I think is implied in the Christian case and the federal case, where if there has been a completion of the maximum ordinary term, to allow sentencing after that, particularly a period that we're talking about here, an additional 10 years after that, would provide for an assumption, if you do it 10 years later, that the defendant has stayed the same during that 10-year delay, that there hasn't been a change of circumstances, and therefore the right of the due process right of the defendant to have an individualized determination as to sentencing, that due process right would be violated, because there's an assumption for 10 years the defendant has stayed the same. Is that your argument?
Because the court has still, under the 706-606 factors, obligated to consider all the circumstances at the time. And I believe, Justice Edens, that's why I answered your question earlier about the bright line rule, because I'm saying in my client's case, because with those facts, I said I would need more facts, because I don't know if the defendant participated in the delay in the circumstances that you gave in that scenario. I know in my client's case, he did not participate in the delay. So in the other case you were describing with misdemeanors, I would say that my client's case is much more severe because it was felonies that were involved and he did not participate anyway in the delay. And that's why I believe the court could impose a bright line rule here and say, once the maximum punishment under alternative punishments is reached, the court could say that that's a bright line, that you cannot do that, kind of similar to the 801 bright line with the indictment issue that has now come before the court, that if there's not an indictment for a felony and it's not contempt and it's not something within the jurisdiction of the court, you can't do that anymore. And the court could impose a bright line rule in this case as well and say, well, for all defendants, if there's multiple alternatives under a sentencing scheme to punish a defendant and he's fulfilled one and he hasn't been either sentenced or resentenced on the other, that the state has now given up its option to, and the court as well, to go forward with an extended or alternative punishment, because he's already fulfilled one of alternative punishments and the delay has severe due process and restraints of liberty implications.
Well, if we go with that argument, the extended was still possible, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Under the circumstances of this case, the extended was still a possibility. So I'm not sure how a bright line rule helps you.
That's why I argue that I'd rather have the facts of this case developed and analyzed. And that's why I did make that argument that it should be done on a case by case basis, because the facts I did give, what if the defendant participated in the delay and caused the delay? He kind of have unclean hands. So, but my client does not. So that's why I'm arguing in this case that I think that it would be appropriate to consider more of a case-by-case basis, because that's who I represent, Stanley Canosa, and that's who I'm arguing for on behalf. And I'll never forget when I was in law school, there was a case called the Bakke case. It was a discrimination
case. Mr. Luis, I think maybe at this point we've gone quite a bit over, and I will give you time for rebuttal, though. Thank you. Thank you for your argument, and I will give you some time for rebuttal. So let's hear from Mr. Tsushima after we clean up the portals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
And for the record, may it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the state of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Morning.
Associate Justices, good morning to you as well. As was discussed before the ICA, when we had oral argument, there is an understandable concern that defendant had to wait 18 months before being resentenced in this case. As this court's well aware, when a case is sent down and remanded for resentencing, it's typically the circuit court that puts it on calendar and sets it, or my office will ask for a status for the case to be set. And this is an unusual case. It doesn't usually happen, but something slipped through the cracks. And I've looked at the record, and there doesn't seem to be an explanation for why it happened. It looks like when the case reached about the 50-month mark, it was sometime in March of 2020 that my office first moved for a status to put it on for sentencing, resentencing. And then it was continued by the court and with the knowledge of the parties for it to be resentenced in June. When I did my initial research on this case, I hadn't done the initial briefing on this appeal. But when I did my initial research, I couldn't find any authority on the matter or anything that spoke to the matter. Since then, though, when this court accepted cert, I did find a number of cases that discussed what the court should look at when there is a significant delay or just a delay in general that the court should consider. And a number of states have analyzed whether an alleged unconstitutional delay in sentencing should be looked at the same way as an asserted denial of a right to a speedy trial. And in over 17 states, a number of them did recognize that right and did say that it would be proper to look at it and analyze it in such manner.
Without a rule? Those states have rules requiring sentencing forthwith or expeditiously?
A couple of the cases that I looked at, they had a similar rule to ours, Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 32, which states after adjudication of guilt, sentence shall be imposed without unreasonable delay. And for that reason, those courts did look to the Sixth Amendment. And the ones that did feel that there is a right said it's by, they just assumed. So, because the U.S. Supreme Court, they just assumed that so that it is connected to it, because the U.S. Supreme Court hadn't explicitly commented on the matter.
There's an outer limit. Some courts have adopted an outer limit for how long it could take to resentence somebody. Is that a fair statement? And by the way, you know, you could have asked to submit a supplemental brief, which would have been helpful probably for the court and for Mr. Luis to be able to respond, because this is something I don't believe was fully argued.
It actually wasn't even brought up in the briefing before, but it came up in
it's helpful, but what you're sort of your argument is there is some outer limit.
I'm just recognizing that, yeah, some courts do recognize a right, and there's also the other side that says, well the Sixth Amendment does mention the right to trials explicitly. I'm just pointing out to the court. I just want to be, you know,
sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Tsushima, but doesn't Justice Ginsburg specifically find that there's a due process right to have a sentence that isn't unduly delayed in the Betterman case, Betterman versus Montana?
Yes, I think there is
And so
there are cases that comment generally, but I don't know that there's a specific one as to the delay in like a resentencing like we have.
In that case, Justice Sotomayor in her concurrence is suggesting using Barker versus Wingo as the test of whether or not there has been an undue delay.
That's exactly what I was going to get to.
But I guess that sort of brings us to the issue that was addressed in United States versus Christian. This is a case that is from the Ninth Circuit, and it's September 2016, where there was an issue as to whether there was a proper enhancement under the federal sentencing scheme, and the court determined that the predicate for enhancing the sentence was invalid. So from that point of view, the court then looked at the ordinary maximum sentence and saw that it had already been served and released the defendant. So it would seem that that's potentially a precedent that could be helpful to this court.
I would want to read Christian first to be able to
I'm just suggesting it to you so you can take a look at it. But yeah, it does get us to this question of, as the CJ was alluding to, so how do we define the idea of due process when it comes to the period of the criminal process of the sentencing period, right?
Right.
And so in this case, is it the argument of the state that basically due process is complied with as long as the sentencing takes place within what would potentially be the maximum enhanced sentence that the defendant could receive? In this case, it'd be 20 years.
Not necessarily. What I was going to bring up and what I want to address that the Chief Justice brought up, there's a reason I didn't cite to any of the specific cases. I don't want to blindside anybody with this. What I was going to tie it back to is what Justice Wilson was bringing up, is that the cases did look at the Barker-Wingo factors, you know, the four factors with respect to speedy trial. But ultimately, what I wanted to say is when you look at those four factors, it is something that we already discussed before the ICA without even citing to any cases, that when there's a delay, ultimately you're going to want to look at is whether defendant was prejudiced in the case. And that's one of the factors in Barker v. Wingo. But if you look at those factors, if this court were to apply them, it does seem also fair in making the analysis, you know, the first being the amount of time that there is a delay, the second being the reason for the delay, the third being whether a defendant raised or asserted his right, and then the fourth being prejudice.
Are you suggesting that the defendant needs to, because those factors in terms of factor three, it's pretrial. It's like right to speedy trial. Are you suggesting that the defendant has an obligation to request that he be sentenced to move for sentencing?
I'm not saying he has an obligation. I'm saying it's a factor the court should consider. I don't think he waives it just by not moving the court to put on for sentencing, but I do think it's a factor the court should consider.
Is it the state's position that in this case, based on the ICA judgment on appeal, the circuit court did not have discretion to not impose the extended sentence?
I guess my answer is two part to that, because first in our briefing, of course, that is the position we took, that as far as the resentencing was concerned, the only thing the trial court had to do was essentially not give the consecutive and then the rest of the sentence stands. I understand that's the argument we made. However, at the sentencing, the trial court essentially didn't buy our argument. They took defendant's argument and said, no, I agree with you. I think I'm supposed to look at everything. Like, we're here for resentencing. I think she said something to that effect. So notwithstanding the position we took,
Do you think that the state's position was consistent with HRPP Rule 35B?
I can see how it could be seen as inconsistent with that.
Then let me ask you this. You do concede that due process does apply to the sentencing phase also, not just under the United States Constitution, but also under the state constitution.
Yes. Yes.
We have repeatedly said that justice requires the appearance of justice. In this situation, because the sentencing was delayed for 18 months, if the court had not imposed extended sentencing, what would have happened? Would the defendant have been entitled to some damages for unlawful incarceration?
I'm not very good on my civil law, Justice McKenna.
Potential due process violation of even a federal 42 U.S.C. violation, potentially?
Yes.
Isn't there a statute that says that if people are held longer than they're supposed to be, they're entitled to compensation?
I believe so.
How do you think that this sentencing satisfies the appearance of justice?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's because the defendant was given his opportunity to make his arguments before the judge.
Do you think that from the perspective of a defendant, the appearance of justice, how could a defendant feel that the court had any option but to impose the extended? Because otherwise, he was supposed to be out 9 months earlier. From the defendant's perspective, how does justice appear?
I would hope a defendant would see our judges as being fair, as understanding that this is the circumstance that was brought before me. I'm not going to protect the state
from
litigation.
Was a new PSI ordered at the resentencing?
Excuse me?
Was a new PSI ordered at the resentencing 4 years later?
I don't recall. I don't recall.
I assume there was one after the second trial, right?
I assume so.
But there was no PSI after the remand.
I apologize. I don't recall looking for the record in the record for one.
But doesn't this make the point about the nature of the due process violation in terms of fairness when you have a circumstance in which the court delay is sentencing, whether or not it's the court, in any case, the sentencing exceeds the maximum ordinary sentence, the time of sentencing, then the court is in a position where if there's a decision made that there won't be enhanced sentencing, you have a circumstance in which the actions of the court have put the defendant in jail longer than he should have been in jail. I don't know why that wouldn't be a very striking example of an unfairness in a system where, unless there's some sort of emergency, and I can't think of an intervening cause, but you know, our process of justice would suggest that we would be able to schedule the sentencing in a way that would mean that the defendant would be able to be released if he serves the sentence or she serves the sentence that's considered to be fair by the judge. I don't know. How would you say that was fair for the court to put the defendant in that position where the court says, yes, actually, there isn't a basis for the enhanced sentencing. I'm sorry that you were held from the point of view of the state, you were held for an additional 9 years until we got around to your sentencing hearing, even if it was just 6 months. How do you explain that to the defendant?
I can't put words into a judge's mouth how they would explain it, but I would have enough faith in our judiciary that's exactly what would happen. If the judge felt that the extended sentences weren't appropriate, that the judge would have said so.
Mr. Tsushima, at some point in time, you had indicated in your argument that one of your arguments was that the judgment on appeal was specific, that only the consecutive terms aspect of the sentence was set aside. And you said there was a second argument what was your second? I want you to go on with your argument.
Oh, just the argument that I argued before the Intermediate Court of Appeals during our argument. It was just basically that we then look at what happened, what the sentencing was, what the trial court had determined. And the trial court had determined that defendant was before her for resentencing, that she could consider all matters, including whether the extended sentence was appropriate. And then she took judicial notice of the entire record, including the order PSI.
Well, wait a second. Does that, if that's your second argument, does it kind of play into the defendant's argument? If it's a brand new day.
I would say no. I don't mean to cut you off, but I think I know where you're going with your question. I would say no, because as I think it was Justice Wilson that pointed out, although the extended sentence finding by the jury is there, it's still within the discretion of the court whether it's appropriate to apply that. So defendant's argument of all this passage of time and matters to consider because of his good behavior while incarcerated were all matters that the court could and did consider in this case. And that's where it's appropriate for the court to consider, not the verdict finding, as Justice Edens pointed out, to be found to be stale for some reason. So that's a finding. Oh, sorry.
I want to come back to the judgment. I asked Mr. Luis about this as well. So the judgment in 2018 read that the 2016 judgment of conviction and sentence is vacated to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences in violation of 706-609 and is remanded for resentencing. Is that the state's position, if I understand it, in your ICA brief was that only set aside the consecutive aspect of the sentencing. But then according to you today, what happened is the trial court went off in another direction and read the judgment as requiring a resentencing completely, correct?
Right.
Okay. Does that, the fact that the trial court got it wrong under the state's view, does that somehow change the judgment or change the analysis? In other words, the court shouldn't have gone ahead and redone it anew, but the judgment on appeal still says what it says. And it says the only thing that the court should have been doing was to get rid of the consecutive. So if that's the case, how is he being prejudiced? How is he being sentenced beyond the underlying term that he'd already served, which is what I think his argument is, if in fact there was still an operative 20-year term?
I would say there isn't a problem or there is an issue with that, because it's same result, wrong analysis of how we got there. So I guess
I would like to clarify then, what is the state's position? Is it your position that the ICA judgment on appeal was appropriate if it did say that the court did not have discretion to not impose an extended sentence? In other words, that we're only setting it aside as to the consecutive, the extended stays. Would that have been a legal judgment on appeal by the ICA?
This is going to be one of the rare occasions where I'm going to say, I don't know.
Right.
I'm stuck with what the sentencing court did in fact do.
Okay. So because courts are supposed to consider the circumstances at the time of sentencing, and Rule 35B clearly recognizes that the court was not required to impose an extended sentence pursuant to Rule 35B, correct?
I agree with you, Justice McKenna.
All right. So then we get back to the issue of the appearance of justice.
Was there a Rule 35B motion filed?
Rule 35B, the court can do resentencing sua sponte. There's no motion required, correct?
In any event, I don't recall a motion being filed in this case.
You know, if extended term sentencing was, let's say, off the table, I know the court considered it on the table, but let's say if it was off the table, I mean, why even have a sentencing hearing?
Well, that's a good point. At that point, yeah, I would think the Intermediate Court of Appeals would have just called the game right there and not have remanded it.
So the interpretation of the judgment, with the language saying that to the extent that there's been a violation of the consecutive sentencing, could be interpreted to mean that the judgment was just identifying the basis for the court's decision. It wasn't necessarily limiting the determination below. It was just saying this is, it was noting that this is the reason for the reason it's being sent back. And then following that, when the court interpreted its own judgment and its decision, it said defendant's status is post-conviction pending resentencing, and the court retains jurisdiction to resentence, and it's a remand as having vacated the prior sentences. So I think interpreting the judgment consistent with the way that the ICA interpreted its own judgment, it was not necessarily saying that it was limiting the court's discretion just to a decision on the extended sentence versus the consecutive.
I can see how it could be interpreted either way. And, you know, I don't mean to beat a dead horse or repeat myself, but I'm stuck with what the trial court had interpreted that phrase to mean.
Can't you argue that the trial court erred? You're not stuck with anything.
I guess I want to be specific. And once the ICA had also affirmed that that's what they meant to be, although a different three panel of ICA judges, that that's what it was interpreted to be. I'm gun shy to still take that position.
The ICA also said it would be absurd to say that the resentencing court was limited to the ordinary term when a finder of fact had already made the determination that an extended term was warranted.
Part of the argument that I made before the ICA was that the authority of the court is what we should be looking at. And the authority of the court is given by statute. And that's actually what the defendant was facing. He's been using terms like, I'm sorry, you had a question.
I understand what you're saying. Because the argument of the defendant is the court was out of authority to give him anything further than the than the ordinary term.
Right. What's your precisely your argument on that point?
That the authority isn't the maximum regular terms. There's nothing in the statutes or rules that says that the authority given to the court for the extended sentence is by statute. And that's the maximum that defendant was facing, not the maximum regular terms. He's been using words like stale or expired. And every time I tried to do searches for those terms when it related to sentencing or extended sentencing, there wasn't a case that used those terms and referred to the regular sentences as expiring or a previous finding being stale.
So you don't believe there's authority that supports that position, and you cite to the extended sentencing statute and say that still provided the court with authority? Is that
correct, Your Honor?
The court had discretion.
Correct, on whether to apply it or not.
It, obviously, to me, the issue is whether the exercise of that discretion satisfies the appearance of justice under the circumstances of this case.
Yes.
And the state's position is that it does. Is that correct?
Yes, because the court explicitly stated that it was going to consider all things that was before the court. I wish I could cite the page, but the court did make a specific finding of that. And
with one of the factors in terms of protection of the public, though, you know, one of those protection of the public being one of the factors, are all three factors required to be found by the jury in terms of extended? I'm sorry, I don't have the extended statute in front of me.
Which I'm going to say no, in that I looked at the jury verdict form and the two check marks they check off is whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was persistent, and whether the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the extended terms, I'm paraphrasing, extended terms are necessary for the protection of the public. And that's the only two things.
Right. So in terms of protection of the public, do you think that there is an issue with respect to staleness if the verdict form is 4 years old?
No, Your Honor, because of what is placed before the jury on a typical extended hearing, and I believe that's made a record in this case, and it's...
Putting aside this defendant.
Okay.
What if the defendant had been out on bail pending the appeal? Do you think that 4-year-old verdict would still be valid as to whether a defendant was a danger to the public?
I would say the verdict is, and again, all those...
Even though the defendant had been out on bail and had a wonderful job and was taking care of the defendant's family, et cetera, during those 4 years. That four-year-old verdict as to whether the defendant is a danger to the public is still valid.
I do.
But just to complete Justice McKenna's scenario, I'm referring to this case. If the extended term is 20 years, the liberty interest is pretty significant in 20 years, right? So to deprive the defendant of an opportunity to, at the time of resentencing, bring up the fact that the evidence has been stale and request additional information, wouldn't that seem to be part of his due process rights?
And that'd be bad if the court did deprive him of that right, but the court allowed him to express these things specifically from defendant's own mouth. He was able to tell the trial court the differences and what has transpired in the meantime.
But an analysis that says that the court can delay beyond the maximum ordinary sentence, delay, I guess, as long as the potential enhanced sentence could take place, promotes the idea that the information to be presented by the defendant isn't that important if it's just being continued to the extent that the evidence could potentially, the information pertaining to sentencing could be outdated.
Well, I don't think the defendant is completely without recourse. I mean, if there is an extended period of time for the trial such that beyond his maximum sentence, if I can just finish the thought, he can always move for a reconsideration of bail at that point. And this case has been going on
for... In this case, wasn't his recourse limited from your point of view? Because from your point of view, isn't it the case that the court can wait until after the ordinary maximum term, and then on this particular case on remand, the court doesn't have any discretion when it comes to the extended sentence. The court has to impose the 20-year sentence.
Right, and he can move to be released on bail. And that would counter that. If the court found that, enough time has passed by that it's at this point.
Well, that's a bail issue. I'm talking about his opportunity to present evidence at sentencing. And, the extended sentences oftentimes are life. Could be life with parole or life without parole, right? If it's a Class A felony, the extension could be that long. So does a defendant, at least when they're facing life, have a due process right to produce fresh evidence after having to wait? I don't know what your position is when it's a life sentence, but if the government says that the court can wait 10, 15 years before bringing the sentencing where you've got that level of enhanced sentencing, I would think it'd be straightforward that the defendant would have a due process right to bring evidence back before the court. Absolutely. On resentencing.
Mr. Tsushima, at some point in time, a jury determined that the extended term for the defendant was appropriate due to, in part, his criminal record. And although in this particular case, he was first convicted of a sex assault and later that was set aside, he'd had previous sex assault.
Yeah, two prior sex assault in the first degrees. And one of the witnesses that testified as his extended term sentencing was a victim from one of those cases.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
He was convicted of two prior sex assaults in the first degree, and one of the witnesses that testified as his extended term sentencing hearing was a victim from one of those prior sex assault cases.
But the sex assault that was ultimately didn't result in a conviction, right? Because
in this case.
Oh, in this case, no.
In the prior cases, he was previously convicted.
Correct. I understood your question to be that.
Sex assault one was set aside.
There was a mistrial on the sex assault one in this case.
In this case, correct.
Right. So that was dismissed.
Mr. Tsushima, anything else for the court at this time?
Nothing else for the court.
Very well. Thank you for your arguments. Some brief rebuttal from Mr. Luiz.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
So a couple points I want to address with the state's argument, especially in response to some of the questions that Justice McKenna raised. And my client is under no obligation to facilitate his own punishment. So I want to put that out, that my client is under no obligation under due process or any rules of court to facilitate his own punishment. That much is clear. And a second question that was raised by the court was whether or not there was an updated PSI. There was no updated PSI. So that's kind of important because it would have been in the record. It would have been sealed in a separate locked cabinet if there was a PSI, and we'd see it in the docket. So it's not there. It never happened. That's my recollection. And I don't see it anywhere in the appellate record that it's sealed and segregated from the rest of the records. That's the next factor. Another point is that the court would have to, with the question with 35B, the court is free to revisit. And if it's more than 90 days under 35B, then the court's supposed to apply a Rule 40 analysis, and the court would not allow that. In fact, if we look at the appearance of whether or not Mr. Canosa thought that he had the appearance of justice in this case, he did not. I mean, he was screaming bloody murder from the courtroom saying he wanted to talk. He was actually disagreeing with some of the arguments that counsel was making, myself. And he was actually asking the court to allow him an allocution and to say a lot more. But the prosecution objected. And basically, the court at that point muzzled Mr. Canosa and said it was not going to let him make any additional arguments. And I was trying to facilitate and allow Mr. Canosa to be able to have an allocution with the court, and that was denied. I'm like, well,
you had filed on his behalf a written document that morning. That was part of the court's point, correct? It was like a 5-page handwritten statement raising a number of issues, which you filed with the court. The court said, I've read your statement, Mr. Canosa. Do you have anything further? In essence, was what I saw in the transcript.
That's correct. And then when he tried to expand a lot further on that and drive all those points home and add to them.
Did the court take a 5-minute recess so he could convey to you what he wanted argued?
Two recesses. Yes, they allowed. However, he still wanted to address the court with an allocution when he was going to be resentenced. And I don't think whatever was issued on the ICA opinion, when you look at the words, therefore, we vacate the circuit court of the First Circuit's June 27, 2016 judgment of conviction and sentence in cap 16497 to the extent it imposes consecutive sentences in violation of HRS 706-609, and remand for resentencing consistent with the summary disposition order. It was not before the ICA in 2018 when it issued its ruling in November 2018. It was not before them whether or not at the time of resentencing on June 4th, 2020, whether it was still appropriate, because the court still is required at the time of sentencing, in addition to due process and notions of fairness under the Constitution of both the United States and the state of Hawaii, it's required to consider the 706-606 factors in 706-606-2C specifically requires the court to consider one of the factors is to protect the public from further crimes of the defendant. And number two, the first one before you get to A through D, is the need for the sentence imposed. And it requires, it says right there in the statute, the plain language is unambiguous, it's clear. 706-606 requires that the sentencing court consider the following factors in determining the particular sentence to be imposed. And for all intents and purposes, the court issued a conviction. That's the original June 4th, 2020 filing, a judgment of conviction and sentence. And also it did an amended one in July and used the same form, judgment of conviction and sentence. And the court was still free and had discretion to consider whether or not Mr. Canosa was a danger to the public. And that was not addressed by the ICA, because the ICA was only looking at, when the ICA issued its decision on November of 2018, it was looking at whether, when the jury entered its findings of fact and said that Mr. Canosa was a danger to the public, that was 2016. And the court was only looking at the limited issue when the jury reached its verdict on in 2016. Did it comply with the Constitution and all the due process rights at that moment when the jury decided in 2016? That is a much separate question, whether or not it's an appropriate sentence in 2020 in June 4th.
Let me ask you if I could to clarify what you're asking for. I know you mentioned that you were intending to file a motion for release pending our decision, but is the relief that you are requesting that the defendant be released forthwith and that there be a reversal at this point? And reversal of the ICA and the determination that the defendant has served his sentence?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a reversal of the ICA and a dismissal of the of any further an order prohibiting any further proceedings with Mr. Canosa, that he's already served his underlying maximum sentence, and that under the principles of double jeopardy, he's not entitled to be resentenced to any further punishment at this point, since he already served the one of three alternative punishments, at least, under the sentencing statute.
I'm sorry, so your argument, and I asked Mr. Tsushima this question, what's the basis for saying that it defaults back to the statutory maximum, which is 10 years? Your argument is based on a double jeopardy theory?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be double jeopardy. I mean, he's already served one of alternative punishments, so he can't serve additional punishments after he's already fulfilled one of, because there's at least three we can think of right off that we're discussing this morning. He has there's an underlying sentence for the underlying charges. Then there can be an enhancement of an extended that requires a finding of necessary to the protection of the public and consecutive. And the one that the court was looking at was the underlying plus the enhanced. But my client was objecting, as I was, that he could not be sentenced at all on that June 4th, 2020, because he already fulfilled the alternatives of several punishments. And
so if you're the state, and what your argument then was, the court didn't have the authority to give him anything. And what do you base that on? That the court didn't have the authority?
That would be the double jeopardy clause, and that was
that this. Means that you're thinking that extended term is putting him at risk again. How is that a double jeopardy?
Because there's alternative punishments, and he served one of at least three that I can think of. Multiple.
I heard your argument before that you said.
So it's double jeopardy because he's being subject to an additional punishment when he already fulfilled.
So if I follow your argument correctly, kind of following up on what Justice Edens had asked earlier, let's say that a defendant is convicted of 10 misdemeanors and sentenced to 1 year each consecutively, right? The court gives no explanation. So on appeal, the consecutive part is set aside for failure to provide reasons as required by our case law. It is your position then that since the defendant had already served the 1 year concurrently for all 10, the court would then be precluded from reimposing a consecutive with reasons being provided?
That's correct, because he already served one of...
Doesn't that conflict with a lot of our case law already? I mean, I'm not sure about all of our consecutive cases, but... we've had various cases where we've set aside consecutive sentences for failure to provide a reason. I'm not sure whether all of the underlyings were satisfied by that time.
That's why I still am advocating for a case-by-case basis, because I think it should be considered under the facts of each case rather than a blanket rule. because again, in that hypothetical, still all the facts don't present itself. But in this case before the court, all the facts do present itself and weigh heavily in favor of Mr. Canosa's argument that there were changed circumstances and the appearance of justice was not fulfilled in this case.
Wait a second. A jury that did not reach a verdict on the sex assault case and convicted your client of burglary and unlawful entry knew of his prior sex assaults and found the criteria satisfied for an extended term, right, in 2016.
Well, I think that's egregious to say that because he has a record of being convicted of sex assault, that now the court, after he's already served that punishment from the past, that's again double jeopardy. Now we're going to, even though in the current case you've been acquitted, well, not acquitted, but you haven't been convicted, there's no conviction. If he's not convicted, it's not supposed to be, because that would be kind of like the Nunes case, talking about when the court felt that, oh yeah, I think you're a gang member too, so I'm going to give you some extra punishment for that. So the court's basically saying, I still think you're a sex predator, and I still think that you should get some additional punishment in this case for previous thing that you've already been punished for, even though you've been not convicted in this case. And without that conviction, that raises serious notions of a due process violation to punish him.
Surely the defendant's history of criminality has to be taken into consideration by a jury in determining whether an extended term is necessary.
I don't know how the court can consider something that happened a long time ago that he already served his punishment and now apply it now and say, I think we should give you an extra punishment in this case, even though you weren't convicted of a sex crime.
And I think the record indicate that's what happened. And I didn't see that as an issue on appeal that you'd raised with us now, that there was a suggestion the court had relied on acquitted or in this case conduct that was not adjudicated. I didn't see that in your cert.
I mean, it is kind of discussed in passing by the prosecutor, kept mentioning the prior, at various stages of the proceedings in the case, the prior sex assaults. And even from what I remember, it's in
talking about the conduct that was subject to the hung jury. But Mr. Luis, we've been going quite a bit of time. Anything further for the court at this point?
No, I just believe on the facts of this case, Mr. Canosa raised the issues that were appropriate, that the court should not have imposed an extended sentence, and he should have been immediately released. And I will be presenting a motion to the court for that in this case.
Very well. Thank you. Both of our counsel for your arguments today. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Thank you very much.
Iku iluna. Please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha. Ho'okolo kolo ki ke hanohano o komoku ain o hoi. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.